Good afternoon, everyone. Peter's just telling me he's chaired a lot of these sessions, but he's never been a guest. So what a delightful turnaround for a famous South Australian. I'm delighted we're here on this gorgeous Adelaide afternoon. It's now winter, but you'd think it was summer, but it's magnificent.
Autumn.
It feels like winter in the morning. My name is Rick Saar. I'm delighted to be your host and MC this afternoon for this session with the famous Peter Gerz. I begin with an acknowledgement that we are meeting on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people, right next door to the Karawira Parry, the name which for millennia was the name given to the river behind us, now known for a few seconds as the River Torrens. And what's astonishing about meeting right here on this piece of land is that this is the time and the place when Uncle Lewis O'Brien was telling me that there would have been tens of thousands of generations of people doing exactly what we're doing this afternoon, sharing stories, heartwarming stories, and learning from each other. So I'm delighted to be carrying on that tradition and acknowledging the spiritual connection that allows us to do that today. Our guest this afternoon is Peter Gerz. I've got a couple of other things I should say. Please turn your phones to silent and don't forget to buy books afterwards, but I'm coming to that a bit later as well. That's the housekeeping. What a wonderful opportunity it is to welcome Peter Gerz this afternoon. Peter is a South Australian household name. For 40 years, an arts critic, producer, director, actor, raconteur, columnist and author. He hosted the evening show with the ABC Adelaide 891 for over 20 years. In the Australia Day Honours 2013, Peter was awarded the Medal of the Order of Australia for his service to the community as a radio broadcaster. Would you please welcome Peter Gerz this afternoon?
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out and enjoying this marvellous Writers' Week. Thanks to Louise Adler for inviting me to be part of it for the first time as an author. And thanks to the technical people who do a marvellous job here. I said to them while they were setting us up, the sound here is always excellent. I hope it is today. Can you hear at the back? See, it's always excellent, the sound. I can't see you over here because I've got a cataract in this eye, so you're all foggy over there. So
they're all good-looking, Peter, don't worry.
Are they good?
Yes, I'm looking out over there at the moment.
Yes.
Peter, let's reflect on 20 years at the ABC. Mm. Things have changed a bit for you since late last year when you gave it away. What's it like now not being in the Adelaide studios of an evening?
I miss the audience. I miss the energy of the workplace, but it was time. You know, I'd had, as you said, over 20 years on that show, and I loved it, but it was time to do other things.
Well, those other things, of course, have included writing this book, and this afternoon we're going to focus on In the Air of an Afternoon Almost Past, A Memoir of Loss. Peter, this story, which we'll come to in a minute, is 40 years old. What motivated you to write it now?
That's a very good question. I think it's a book about grief, and I think grief has become the theme of our times. It seems every second book you read is about grief. I just finished Christos Tsiolkos's novel, The In-Between, which is about grief. Every second movie or TV show you watch seems to be about grief. For some reason, grief is the theme of our time. I think it's not just the people we've lost, but it's also what we've lost. I think in society, we're all grieving. I think grief has become much more public since Princess Diana's death. You know, the way that eulogies have become very prevalent now in funerals and memorial services, much more prevalent than they were. I think for some reason, I don't really know why, grief has become so important to us. And we all grieve. Grief unites us all, but we all grieve individually. You and I may lose someone whom we both knew, and we grieve for that person in a different way. We grieve individually. Part of the reason I wrote it was because, you see, the difficult thing about grief is not the immediate loss, because generally you're supported. No matter how sudden or not a death is, you're supported. And there's a kind of a process you go through, difficult as that may be. But what's difficult about grief is 25 years later or 30 years later or 40 years later in this case, you suddenly think, who were these people? What did they smell like? What did they feel like? What did it feel like when they kissed you on the cheek? What did it feel like when they hugged you? And you can't remember. They've sort of disappeared from you. And that's a very, very difficult thing, I think. And I suppose I wrote it to revive them, my parents, and to revive them in my heart, I suppose, and also that of my sister.
We'll come and talk to you about your sister a bit later, but tell us about your parents. You were in your early 20s when you lost them.
Yes.
What do you remember?
Well, you see, I was very fortunate. The best thing that can happen to a person is to be raised with love. And I was certainly, my sister and I were raised with love in a loving family in Woodville. And they were good people. My father, I think I had a complicated relationship with my father, like, you know, because he was of that generation, he wasn't tactile, he wasn't, he didn't seem appreciative of me. But I knew there was love there. I was very close to my mother. She was a very loving, intelligent woman. And they were both my parents were only children. You see, we were Methodists, and their parents were Methodists, so they tried sex once and didn't like it. And so yes, they were both only children. So, yes, it was a suburban lifestyle, and we were raised with affection and regard.
So let's talk about the event that caused the grief and that forms the subject of this book. Can you take us through the narrative, where they were and where you were?
Yes. My father had started his working life on the assembly line at Phillips at Hendon. He was the son of a factory worker at Holden's, a GMH. My grandfather worked for 47 years at GMH. And he then became a commercial traveller. Then he developed an interest. You see, that generation, William McInnes writes about this so well, they were hobbyists. You know, they developed hobbies. And he had various hobbies. For example, he won the Queen's Shoot, which sounds funny now, doesn't it? at the Dean Range, and firing 303s as a target shooter. And then he developed a hobby making Super 8 movies. And this brought him into, he would take movies of people's weddings, mainly Italians and Greeks. Then this brought him in to work as a still photographer, and he worked as a wedding photographer and a portrait photographer, and became quite successful as that, working from the back of the house. And he went to a photographic conference with my mother in, they were going to Las Vegas. And they were en route to Las Vegas, and they'd stayed in New Orleans, I think, for about a week. And they were due in Las Vegas on the 2nd of July, sorry, the 9th of July, 1982, and never made it.
The plane crashed. Tell us what happened.
I was alerted by my grandmother that there had been an accident in America. When this happens, and when you're told this, something in you dies. You know, you think, and then you hope against hope that that's not the case. And when my grandmother rang me, and I was, you know, hungover, I had a play that had just opened here at the Little Theatre, now in its 50th year at the university. And in those days, one could sleep till the crack of noon. Remember that? Yes. But she was ringing. The phone was ringing at 11 o'clock in the morning and waking me up, and I was sort of resentful of this. And she said, there's been an accident, a plane crash in America, and it corresponds to your mum and dad's itinerary. And I said to her, oh, Nana, for heaven's sake, you know, there's thousands of planes going off and coming in all the time, you know, with no idea that it was theirs. But something in me knew from that moment. And then you go into a sort of denial, which lasted another 5 hours until we heard from Pan American Airlines that that both of my parents, my father aged 52, my mother aged 50, had perished with 154 other people, 146 people in the plane, all hands, and 8 people on the ground, including 4 children, because the plane had got, as we subsequently found out, it had got 100 feet off the air, which is not much higher than these trees, really, and come down in a suburb, killing, and it had happened at 4:09 in the afternoon, so there were children back from school on the street who were killed, shockingly. So all hands, it was a cataclysm.
And it was wind shear, is that what they put
it down? It was wind shear, yes. Yeah. There were then no alerts for wind shear. There are now. I mean, that was one good thing to come from that terrible accident, that now they give wind shear reports customarily for planes, particularly in areas where that are wind shear prone, such as the New Orleans airport.
Peter, in the book you talk about the fact that they had only gone to New Orleans because you had suggested it, and you write about your own feelings of guilt. Have you been able to overcome those feelings now?
Isn't this strange? When I was writing the book, I spoke to a couple of people, my sister, of course, and it brought my sister and I closer together, because we suddenly realised that we had never discussed this in 40 years, that we'd never really talked it through. And both she and a friend of mine, Rob Cosenza, who joined me in New Orleans briefly, and another friend who helped find Rob, who was with his wife in Zurich on a delayed honeymoon, all remembered that I had been the one to tell my parents to go to New Orleans, and I had completely forgotten that. I'd emptied that out of my brain. It was a shock to me. But then recalled that, of course, I did. And, I mean, that's fate, isn't it? I mean, I might have been with them, in which case, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here at Writers' Week, obviously.
The Pan Am authorities didn't cover themselves in glory. They flew you over there. Tell us about that narrative, about heading to New Orleans and going through the shenanigans with Pan Am.
Well, that now is a nightmare because, you know, here I am, I'm 25, I've never left Australia. We're in the dead of a cold, it was a particularly cold Adelaide winter, and I'm told that I have to leave to go to New Orleans to identify the bodies, and I would be leaving tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. And this was horrifying to me, to the point that I was with friends by this point, and they were trying to convince me in the dead of the night that there was no need to take, I would be going to a very hot place. New Orleans is semi-tropical and very humid, and why would I be taking a Harris tweed jacket and corduroy trousers from various op shops? I wouldn't need them, and I just couldn't hear that. So I arrived in New Orleans with the most inappropriate wardrobe. Yes, and imagine getting on a plane. You've just lost 2 parents in a plane, so now you'll get on a plane. And in those days, as some of you would recall, you know, you hopped internationally. There were fewer long-distance flights. So we went from Adelaide. Imagine getting on a plane and flying from Adelaide to Melbourne, where I had to get an emergency passport and an emergency visa from the American consulate, thence to Sydney, thence to Hawaii, thence to Los Angeles, Los Angeles, Houston, Houston, New Orleans. And the flight from, I broke down in Los Angeles. I was parked in an airport hotel, and I walked into the room, and I remember the movie Little Murders was showing on the television, And I was then drinking cognac for some reason that they'd sent up. And I was drinking but not able to get drunk. And I had a sort of breakdown. I couldn't move. And I had to ring for assistance. And a bellboy came and found a Pan-American person. And they practically carried me down to the lobby and then to the departure gate, where I sat near the departure gate in a cafe and again felt that I couldn't move. I had to be assisted onto a plane, which I subsequently realised was a ghost flight. It was the oldest plane in the Pan Am fleet, and there was only one other passenger, so clearly they'd put it on for me. And we flew through a lightning storm. I've never been in a plane with so much turbulence, and looking out the windows to lightning. It was terrifying. And the only other passenger declined to sit with me. And I remember I'd bought a copy of the Los Angeles Times, and there was a profile of George C. Scott, and I memorized it. I sat there and memorized the first seven paragraphs to keep my mind off what was happening. And thence to New Orleans, and the first person I met there was a man called, inevitably, Chuck. Which is what I wanted to do at this point. Chuck. And he looked like, you know, he was Chuck from Central Casting, like a quarterback. And he was a Pan Am representative. I never saw him again. He walked me from where I arrived at the airport to a taxi.
And, of course, all this time, the ruse was that you were there to identify the bodies. That wasn't true, was it?
No, because within minutes of arriving at the Sheraton Airport Hotel, where they had put me and other grieving family members, I was summoned to a meeting with Pan American lawyers who said there was no apology. They said, here's a check for $10,000. If you sign this, you can go straight back to Australia. And I said, well, I'm signing nothing, and I'm here to identify my parents. And they said, no, well, that's not necessary because, you know, your parents have been killed in what essentially became a firebomb, and the identification is all forensic, so it's dental, and you will never see them. So you're here only to discuss compensation. So I had been immediately completely misled.
And, of course, also overcome with grief at that time. Was this compounding? Was there any counselling? Were there any...
None at all. And we had no... you know, I look now at, for example, other disasters, the way that diplomats and politicians reach out. Not a single politician or public figure ever contacted my sister or I. Not one. Ever. So we were completely left alone. At one point in crisis in New Orleans, I rang the nearest consulate, which was in Houston, only to be told that they were a trade mission only and could do absolutely nothing for me. So we were completely alone.
Now, throughout the book, your sister Jenny shines through like a beacon of light.
Mm.
Share with us what mementos... sometime later she was able to retrieve. Tell us that story.
I think she brought back my mother's watch, which was still working, and my father's watch, which I have, which was the hands were fused into the face of the watch, with the heat of the fire, the hands were fused in at exactly the time of the crash, which was 4:09. So there it is for eternity, fused in there. But yes, she was able to claim some jewellery, but not all.
It's interesting that you were there. She wasn't there at the time.
They never offered... They only offered me... offered for me to go. It was never suggested that I could take anyone else. I wished I had. Subsequently, my aforementioned friend, Rob Cosenza, who was found in Zurich. Pan Am, then once I got there, they said, oh, you didn't bring anyone with you. And I said, well, that wasn't offered. And they said, would you like someone here? And I said, well, yes, because my friend had been found. And Pan Am flew him from Zurich to New Orleans, and he was with me for 2 days, and then flew him back to his wife to continue his honeymoon. Subsequently, they tried to charge us for those airfares, and indeed my airfares. Yes. But it was marvellous to have a friend with me, even for 2 days.
But eventually you got some good legal advice. Tell us about how you kind of warded off this ghoulish company.
Well,
my compensation.
It's funny, isn't it? What you can do under stress. You know, Chekhov said this: any fool can survive a crisis. It's the day-to-day living that wears you out. And while I was sitting with my grandmother, waiting for Pan Am to call that terrible afternoon, waiting for 5 hours, I had the presence of mind to compile a list of everybody who would need to know, you know, various people to come and be with my grandmother, her relations, a lawyer, an accountant, all of that sort of, a funeral director, all of that. So I was in touch with my father's lawyer, who's sadly no longer extant, Warren Jarrett, and he said, just sign nothing, which was the best possible advice. So I had the presence of mind to do that.
And how did it unfold? How did you end that experience? What happened in the days after that? I think you were stuck in the hotel for...
We were stuck in the hotel.
Almost like you were trapped.
Yes, I was a prisoner of the Sheraton Airport Hotel. I was aware that there were other grieving families there, but I was told to speak to no one. They put fear into me, saying... because the American compensation system is... the lawyers take one-third. You'd be familiar with this, Rick.
They always make it divisible by three very easily.
Yeah. Yes, because the lawyers take a third of the compensation. So they said, you know, there are ambulance-chasing lawyers from all over America who've descended on New Orleans, and they will want you. So this was the fear. Also, we were not to... they just didn't want us talking to other grieving family members. So I felt completely alone, which was awful. Also, I was looking out the window of the hotel, and I could see where the crash site was. I couldn't see much, but I knew where it was. It was only about 3 kilometres away, and I wanted to go there. See, this is natural. Anybody who's lost anyone violently, for example, a car crash, you want to see the instrument of death. You don't believe it until you see that. Otherwise, it's just in the abstract. So I wanted to go there. I also wanted to see the emergency workers and thank them. I'm watching it on the television, of course, in the hotel room. I can see it all happening. I can see the wreck. I can see the result of the wreck and the fire and the way that the plane had carved through a suburb. But I can't go there. And I kept asking Pan Am to take me. I said, well, why can't I just get a taxi and go there? And they said, well, no, it's all cordoned off. You won't be allowed in there. No, we will not let you go for some reason. And then sitting in my room one day, the phone rang, and a man said, I'm the secretary of the Archbishop of New Orleans. By this point, the Times-Picayune, the main newspaper in New Orleans, had got wind of the fact that the next of kin were all staying, or most of us were staying at the Sheraton Airport hotels. And also, they'd published a picture, probably from The Wire, of me, and it said that I was interested in the theatre and so forth. So this man said, would you speak with the Archbishop of New Orleans? And I said, yes, of course. I said, I'm thinking, what do you call an archbishop? I remembered, I think, from a play, Your Grace. So His Grace came on the phone, and he expressed sympathy and said, how can I help you? And I said, well, Your Grace, I'm not a Catholic. He said, I didn't ask you that. He said, how can I help you? I said, well, I'd like to go to the crash site, but Pan Am is denying me this. And he said, what? Incredible. He said, I'll call you back in 10 minutes. 10 minutes later, he rang back and said, there'll be a car downstairs for you in about 2 minutes to take you to the crash site. I said, what did you do? How did you achieve this? He said, easy. I rang my contact at Pan Am and I said, there's a grieving Australian boy here and he needs to see the crash site. Unless you take him immediately, my next call will be to ABC, NBC, CBC and the Times Picayune and every radio station in New Orleans. It was a lesson in media. And so I went and saw and was able to thank the National Guard, the Red Cross, the police, the AMBOs, those people, meet some of the people who'd been affected and who'd lost people on the ground, see the wreckage, and that brought a certain catharsis.
Tears?
Reality.
Tears?
Yes, and the smell of death mingled with the smell of magnolias and damp and the humidity and smoke.
Can you still smell that?
I can, yes. Every time I would smell a magnolia, I'm brought back to that moment. It's a Proustian moment, isn't it? The smell of magnolias I associate with death, really.
Now, those of you who do buy a copy of this book, and I encourage you to do so, it's a very a difficult read, but a beautiful read in that sense. You'll find some of the best writing on grief that I've ever read. Was writing about grief something of a catharsis, Peter, 40 years on? How did you feel as you wrote those words?
See, there would be writers present here, and even more importantly, readers. I don't like writing. I really hate writing. I write very regrettably. You know, my column in the Sunday Mail is now in its 33rd year, and writing for newspapers is a chore. I'd started writing for newspapers to give me the discipline to write creatively, but writing for newspapers only gives you the discipline to write to a deadline. If you said to me, write a short story by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, I probably could, but that's an arbitrary deadline. Do you like writing, Rick?
I do like writing.
So you're lucky. I envy that. But as Dorothy Parker so famously said, I don't like writing, but I like having written. And that's a very different thing. You know, finishing this book and my previous book was a marvellous experience, finishing them. So was it cathartic? Yes, I suppose it was. I really wrote it for my sister, who has done the loss much harder than me, because she, unlike me, brought up two children without grandparents, without her own mother, which I think is very hard for her. And she returns to New Orleans almost every year now to the memorial, and she's become friends with survivors and other next of kin, and it's become a big part of her life. So I really wrote it, I think, in a way, as a tribute to her.
Indeed. And I should say, this cover is superb. I'm just looking at the back here. Adelaide Airport Landing Lights, a painting in 2004 by Richard
Moravec.
Moravec. I do like that. Peter, tell us about the title, In the Air of an Afternoon Almost Past, A Memoir of Loss. How did you choose those words for the title?
I think the painting's better than the book, actually. I love this cover. And I've really blessed Richard Moravec, who is a wonderful artist. And he, I admired this picture because it's the picture is the book, and the book is the picture. And I told him that at the time I saw it, and he very kindly gave me a print of it. And I treasure that painting. It's a beautiful painting. I don't know where the... I was going to call it Carelessness originally, from the Oscar Wilde aphorism, to lose one parent is a misfortune. To lose two looks like carelessness. But I think this is a better title. And it's a bit Tennessee Williams, this title. Who is an influence on the whole book.
Shall we go to the Tennessee Williams story, Peter?
Well, you see, that's why I think I told my parents to go to New Orleans, because of my obsession with Tennessee Williams. I had done The Glass Menagerie, and I wanted to do Streetcar as a director, which I eventually did after going there. Once I was there, I realised that I could then do Streetcar Named Desire. You don't understand that play until you're there. The noise and the heat of New Orleans is such a character in that play. With sitting in the hotel room with my friend Rob Cosenza, the actor, and he said, you know, you've been here for 5 days, you've seen nothing but this room. Why don't we go to the French Quarter? And meanwhile, a friend, a sort of family connection, a war bride of a sort of family member in Perth, had managed to find me, called Werner Weisgerber. And so I was liaising with her, and I said, look, we're going to go into the French Quarter. And she said, oh, it's unsafe. Oh, you know, you'll be mugged. And I said to Rob, you know, do you think it's unsafe? And he said, well, how can it? It's one of the most touristed areas in the world. How can it be unsafe? But see, I was unworldly. I'd never left Australia. So in we go in a taxi. And we get out of the taxi on Bourbon Street, and we're walking across the zebra crossing, and I'm halfway across when a woman grabs me by the arm and spins me around. I'm thinking, I'm being mugged, no? On top of all this, I'm being mugged. And she said, Peter Gurs! And it was Leona Gay, who was an Adelaide actress and television personality, who had just married Bill Davies, the former manager of Channel 9 here, and they were on their honeymoon. Yes, a small world. And they knew that I was in New Orleans because of reading it in the paper, but couldn't find me. So they were very helpful to me for a couple of days. Anyway, Rob and I wandered around the French Quarter, and we went to a theatre, and said, by any chance, is Tennessee Williams in town? And they said, well, yes, he is, actually. And they told us where he lived, on Royal Street. And they said, you can't miss it because it's across a from a laundromat that he owns. And it's on a corner, this house. So round we went. And we knocked on the door. The house was on dead on the corner, and the front door was right on the street, and there were windows on both streets. And we knocked on the door, and after a while, the trissiest young man I have ever met came to the door. The sort of young man who could put S in banana. And he opened the door and stared at the two of us up and down and said, yes. And we said, oh, we're from Australia and we're theatricals and we'd love to meet Mr. Williams if we could just say hello. You know, we revere Mr. Williams. And he looked at us up and down again and said, never heard of him, and slammed the door in our faces. And we walked around to the other side of the house on Royal Street, and there were windows with shutters. And Williams was a short man, and suddenly the shutters parted inches from us, and these dark eyes looked out at both of us. And I knew it was Tennessee Williams. And then slowly the shutters closed. And I turned to my friend Rob and said, if you'd been prettier, we'd have been in there. So that was as close as I got to it.
You did just see him passing by and let you...
Exactly.
...loved him as you die.
But the play, on my parents' gravestone, which was at Centennial Park until we had them exhumed from Centennial Park, mainly because why aren't cemeteries perennial? You know, it's shocking, isn't it? It's an impost.
Well, they've got to make some money, I think, Peter.
Well, you know, it was to cost my sister and I $7,500 to leave two graves, the grave of my parents and their cremated remains and that of my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, next door for the next 20 years, I think. And, you know, I may not be here, my sister may not be here, and that's an impost to leave on a niece and nephew who never knew these people. And what if they can't be found? And then they're dug into the ground. So we had them exhumed, and they're now sitting in cupboards, and I'm waiting to think of an appropriate place to put them, but whether to scatter the ashes. But I can't bear to do that. I can't bear to let them fall yet again, even much more gently, to the earth.
You just mentioned your grandparents. You came home. Of course, each of them had lost an only child.
Yes.
So how did you narrate the story to them and alleviate their grief?
See, I was with my maternal grandmother when the news came. She was a very good Christian, and I honour that. And her faith got her through that. And, you know, when we had the news, I just held her and recited Psalm 23. But my other grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was agoraphobic, and I knew that she would not have been listening to the radio or watching the television. She would have no idea. So at 6:30 that night, I had to go round and tell her that her only son was now, her only child was now dead, which was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. I feel for people who have to do that. It was very, very hard. And they grieved in different ways. Basically, my paternal grandmother was never the same. My maternal grandmother was strengthened by her faith, really. But yes, it was very difficult.
You talked about your Sunday Mail column, and I prompted you before we came on stage here today that I would actually quote something you wrote earlier this year that captured my attention, given the faith of your grandmother. And I'd like you to reflect on what you wrote. These words inspired me, and I'd like you to reflect on them. Here's what you wrote back in January, I think. There are many excellent Christians and many excellent people of no faith. Faith and democracy need less dogma, less elitism, less entitlement, more tolerance, and more faith in people. Was something coming out of your experience with this horror something that informed that view, or is that a more recent view?
I don't know. That's interesting, isn't it? I don't even remember writing that.
I'll give you a copy of it a bit later, yeah. If you'd like.
No, but I did. Yes, I think there's a lot to be... You know, the older one gets, the more one values kindness, don't you? Kindness and generosity of spirit, yes. And I think that's key. Yes.
Well, also, Peter, you talked about the love of associates and friends. You would have felt that upon your return. What was that like? Did people feel or able to share that with you? Was it a little bit difficult?
People's reactions are different. See, I thought this was an old story, you know, which is why when I was writing it, I thought, oh, really, who will be interested in this? Because I thought that it was a story that I'd told, but actually I hadn't told it. I'd told little bits over the years. It was fairly general knowledge about these deaths and this grief, but I had never really told the whole story. And there it is. And I suppose that was a catharsis, yes.
Well, I can assure you, I read the book in 2.5 hours and I couldn't put it down. It was, as I say, it was one of the most profound discussions of a man's individual grief and where he's gone with that grief in the last 40 years that I've ever read. What I'm going to do is ask one more question as we head towards the kind of 15-minute question time. And as I'm asking that question and Peter is answering it, if you'd like to ask a question, there is... Abby's going to put a microphone somewhere. Abby, where's that going to go? Right there, next to the shade. So if you'd like to ask Peter a question, if you can make your way there, we'll have question time in a few minutes. Peter, my last question is simply, how did this all wrap up in the end? Yes, you had your time with Tennessee Williams, albeit rather brief.
Yeah.
In the end, how did you escape the ghouls of Pan Am using your best legal advice at the time?
Well, I mean, after I think it was about nearly 2 weeks that I was there, just waiting for bodies to be identified. Eventually they were, thanks to the interventions of the dentist Graham Mount and the marvellous forensic odontologist here at Adelaide University, Dr. Kenneth Brown. The dental charts were used to finally identify the remains of my parents. Then once the identification was achieved, Pan Am said, do you want to take remains back in coffins, or do you want to take them as cremains, that American term? And I said, mainly to piss Pan Am off, I said, no, I'll take them in coffins. And when I arrived at the airport expecting two coffins, they delivered cremated remains. So they didn't even honour that. Subsequently, they tried to charge me, or the estate, for, you know, my airfares. I was followed around in New Orleans. For example, it was a great kindness, speaking of kindness, because in the Times-Picayune it had mentioned that I worked in the theatre. Every single theatrical and cinema management in New Orleans contacted me and said, you are welcome at any time at any of our shows or screenings.
That's the arts community, Peter.
It was the arts community. And that was an enormous boon to me, because I would go every night to the theatre or to a cinema, because sitting in the dark, looking at a stage or a screen, I felt safe. And those people surrounded me with regard and love, and I so appreciated that, as did the common people of New Orleans, you know, because, you know, the whole city was grieving from this terrible cataclysm. So I appreciate it. But then Pan Am, they'd had someone following me around, and then said, well, so much for the grieving son, he was at the theatre every night or the cinema every night. And I felt that was very cruel.
Okay, I'm looking at a blank microphone here. I'm encouraging you to come and ask a question. There being not a person, I will ask another one. Peter, we've all been in that situation. Every year, I'm sure, people who are grieving, there are people who want to grieve with you but don't know what to say. What were the best things that people said to you in that time of enormous grief in the months and years that followed?
Oh, people just today. Somebody in the book tent came up and said, you know, I remember your mother, da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's lovely. And it brings you to them, to you, when people remember them. And, yes, so that's the best thing that anyone ever said to me was, I hadn't been back for a few days, and because the funeral, the memorial service, was on my birthday, my 26th birthday in 1982, which made, you know, rather ruined birthdays for a long time. But my friend Harold Tittleman, the critic, saw me at an opening night about a week after I'd got back. And he said, oh, Peter, dear, how was America? And I laughed and said, well, it was good. You know, it was strange, but thank you for that. And it kind of, I appreciated that in a way, because it wasn't yet another expression of condolence. And it was a bit like, you know, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Roger, your question.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Peter, on radio, you alluded to Pan Am asking about your parents' state of health, which you took at the time as being out of interest, but there was a more sinister motive, I gather, behind that.
They immediately wanted all medical information, and this was, which we acceded to that request as quickly as we could, because they told us it would help the identification process, only to be told, well, your mother had varicose veins, so therefore she probably had a heart condition, so therefore she would have been dead in 10 years. Your father smoked, he had a cataract, which probably meant he was diabetic, and it would have had lung cancer and would have been dead in 5 years anyway. So this was used against us, Yes. You know, it's little people against a corporation, which is hardly a new story. Thank you.
I see another question. Thank you.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for speaking. I don't want to say it was brilliant, but you come across so well, like you speak about it so eloquently. I wanted to ask, did you make the bastards pay? I hope you did.
See, this is strange. Do you know, neither my sister nor the lawyer Warren Jarrett nor me can remember what we were paid. I think, you know, it bought a couple of houses and, you know, it was eventually pissed up against the wall. It was blood money. It made me the worst of, not the worst of it, but, I mean, how could there be anything worse? It made me very self-destructive for a very long time. Because you think, what's the point of living when you can, you know, these people have been snuffed out in the prime of their lives, so what's the point? You know, maybe I won't see 30 or 40 or 50. And so I was self-destructive for quite a while.
At least you got more money.
It didn't really...
It wouldn't compare. Thank you.
Next question.
The Friends of the ABC...
This is the voice of the Friends of the ABC in Adelaide, I should
add. Daryl Reagan. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, Peter. Can I just say that in your post-ABC career, Peter is now patron of ABC Friends in South Australia.
Proudly, yes. Yes, thank you.
My experience was when I got to 62, I decided to find my birth parents. And I was adopted when we were 6 weeks old, my sister and I. Do you think as we get to the age where we lose our parents, we reflect on their time and what they were doing at that age as we move into that age group? When we're younger, we tend to be occupied with kids, but suddenly we have time to reflect when we get into our 50s and 60s. Do you think that was something that you experienced, that at 50 or 60 you started to realise my parents were lost at this age?
Yes, certainly when you get to that age, you think, you know, I'm now older than them. They were, yes. But I think, see, a lot of people have said to me over the years, one's contemporaries, they say, Peter, in many ways, you know, as they watch their parents with dementia or all kinds of illness, or they become difficult or needful, and they say, in many ways, Peter, you were lucky. And I say, well, no, get fucked. You know, that's missing the entire point. What if? And also, I read something recently about this that really resonated, that it's when you lose people, you also lose a lot of past because you lose, and I have this with, I've always had older friends, and suddenly you lose that connection. So you lose the connection. You know, I don't know anybody who can tell me what I was like as a 5-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 15-year-old. There's almost no one to fill that in. But more importantly, you miss the future of those relationships and what might have been and what might have developed in those relationships. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, having had such a shocking experience very young, and particularly of losing people close, you know, that experience of you can be here one moment and not the next.
Yes.
Just kind of world shattering, really. I'm just wondering if it's really taken 40 years to be able to write the story and tell the story.
In a way, yes. Because then you have more distance from it. And I was determined to write it as I remembered it, as it happened, the kind of nightmare unfolding, yes. But yes, that's a good point, actually, something I hadn't really considered. Because there's always, in any piece of art, if art this is, there's always the subconscious that the reader finds, that the author or, you know, dramatist or artist has no idea of. That's interesting. Thank you.
And next question, thanks.
Peter, my name is Mark. I grew up in Adelaide. I left for 45 years and returned 4 months ago. Unfortunately, I didn't get to hear you on the radio.
Well,
thank you very much for your generous gift and including the sharing today. I lost my mother to cancer 21 years ago, and everybody told me I should get over it. Mm. They were all very supportive for 6 or 12 months and then became, frankly, irritated.
Mm.
That the grief for me took more than a decade.
Mm.
It's very painful. And so I guess I want to ask you, do you have any advice? It was a very lonely experience for me.
Mm.
Do you have any advice for people that are not dealing with their grief and getting over their grief as quickly as they should?
Mm. No, because it's individual. No, everyone grieves, as I said, individually. And, you know, time does heal, but that's what people tell you. And it does heal, but it doesn't heal completely. You know, there's always that scar. There's always that loss. There's always that hole. And I can't tell you any more. But just hang on to what you had, always. Try and remember what you had.
Thank you. Mark, I can tell you that Richard Feidler did a fabulous interview with Peter. Some of you may have heard that a number of months ago when the book first came out. So if you go to the ABC Listen playback, go to the Conversation or Conversations site and just search for Peter's name and you'll hear a fabulous interview going through this story again and talking about some of those questions. I'd encourage that.
On a lighter note, speaking of Richard Feidler, I was very grateful to that interview on Conversations, and very grateful to you for your perspicacity here, Rick Saar. Yes, thank you. You're very sympathetic. At the end of the Feidler interview, we were talking because, see, as I've been an avid reader all my life and an avid book collector and book buyer. And although nowadays, you know, I can't remember what I've read. There's an Anne Enright novel in there called The Actress, and I can't remember whether I read it or not. Anyway, and indeed, I needed a book called The Cleansing of Muhammad about the Battle of Broken Hill, and I was in Broken Hill in 2015 for the centenary of the Battle of Broken Hill, the only armed incursion on Australian soil in the First World War, and I remembered this book, and I couldn't remember whether I'd owned it or read it. And so I looked it up on Abe Books, a second-hand book site, found a copy at Adelaide Booksellers, bought it for $20, $2 to $5 postage. Two days later, it arrived. It was my own copy. With my name in it, with the marginalia. But it's a thrill as an author, and any authors will know this thrill, to go into a bookshop and see one's own books there. And that's thanks to Wakefield Press, thanks to Michael Bolan and Wakefield Press, who, you know, Wakefield is an ornament on our society, and we should be very grateful and support Wakefield Press. So it's a thrill to... Yes, thank you.
Well,
it's a thrill to see one's own book. But as I said to Feidler, it's my ambition, you know, as an avid op shopper, I now go into op shops and go straight to the books to see... I'm waiting for my own books to come into the op shop. And he said, well, make sure you see who you've signed them to and who's divested copy. And he said about his friend Kate Kennedy, the Sydney... author, and she was walking along a street in Sydney and passed a second-hand bookshop, and there was a sale rack, and she looked and saw one of her own books, and she thought, I wonder if I signed it to someone. And she opened it up to the title page, and it said, To Mum and Dad Love Kate.
Well,
there you go.
I'm pleased that we're finishing on something of a lighter note, but we have another question. Well, I might make this the last question. Yes. Thank you.
It'll be short. I'm Rosalind from 18 Glenrowan Road, and I can tell you what you looked like when you were five.
Can you?
What was he like, do you know?
Very cute little blonde boy.
What number?
Energetic. 18.
Oh.
Our back doors.
Yes, exactly.
Each other with
yes.
No gate between
That's
us.
That's right. Yes. Mm. Ah. Thank you, Roslyn. Thank you. Wow. Oh.
Is there anyone else here who is a neighbour or a school friend of Peter's who'd like to come forward?
Yeah.
Peter would buy you a coffee afterwards if you can join him. Peter, I do want to ask one more question before we finish up. And this is alluding to the question we had a little while ago about coping mechanisms. I know that you hit the bottle a little bit, but sobriety is now the name of the game. Can you tell us about that transition?
Well, yes, in those self-destructive years, I became a binge drinker. I was not an alcoholic. I was just a binge drinker. I would drink to pass out, which is not pretty. And on December the 10th, 1987, I thought, I can't go on like this, and stop drinking. I've been teetotal ever since.
December the 10th?
1987.
There we go.
So it's a long time.
And look
time.
What a healthy specimen he is now.
Tobacco has been a lot harder. Fortunately, I never missed alcohol, and it turned me into the wowser I was born to be.
Well, we're coming to the end of the afternoon session.
What a shame.
As we end this particular session, Peter was talking about the way that he loves to see his books in the bookstores, and he's talking about a pile of books. What he would love to see is that pile diminish rapidly. And so if you'd like to head to the tent, and I can assure you, in the air of an afternoon almost past, is a compulsive read. I really, if I can say the word, enjoyed it, Peter. It's, as I say, the most profound discussion I've had of a person's grief. It talks about coping. It talks about what it is that helped and didn't help. It talks about love. It talks about kindness. It talks about friends. And importantly, it talks about his parents and the love of his sister as well, Jenny. So if I can encourage you to purchase a copy, Peter will be around to sign it. And if I can also encourage you to put your hands together to thank Peter Gerst.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you, Writers Week. Thanks, Rick Saar. Thank you, technical people. Thank you for your attention.